Hey, good morning. Originally, I was planning to come in here today to tell you that I wanted to do something a little bit different today because I had a few different ideas what to speak about in this parsha. And I had like a short little idea, what we call in Yiddish a vort, on each one of them. I thought to do something a little bit different instead of giving a unified shiur, to just do a series of small vertlach, as they say. But I think it may have actually come together into one big picture. I'm not sure. So I'll share two or three ideas, and at the end you'll tell me if it's really one or not. But let us start with... there's a fundamental shift that takes place in Parshat Bo. For the first time since the beginning of the Torah, we have a lengthy section of mitzvot, of laws. Until now, the Torah has been essentially, although there are a few mitzvot scattered throughout Sefer Bereishit, but fundamentally, Sefer Bereishit and the beginning of Sefer Shemot as well are purely narrative. Whatever mitzvot there are sort of mentioned in the context of a narrative, but it's a narrative. And for the first time, we have a lengthy series of legal passages that are not narrative, a different genre, if you will. A genre that, of course, appears again in Sefer Shemot. The whole second half of the Sefer is pretty much this genre. The entire book of Vayikra, with very few exceptions, few psukim only. Other than that, the entire book of Vayikra is legal in nature, as are significant sections of the books of Bamidbar and Tvarim. So, it begins here. And according to the first Rashi in the Torah, actually, I think we may have referenced that Rashi at some point, I don't recall. But Rashi begins his commentary to the Torah in the beginning of Rashi with the assumption that the Torah, in theory, should have begun from here. Because the Torah is really about mitzvot. And has to explain why it doesn't, etc. So in the Perek Yud Bet, in chapter 12 of the book of Shemot, we read, Vayomer Hashem Moshe v'Laharon be'eretz Mitzrayim le'mor. And here begins the mitzvot. HaChodesh hazeh lachem rosh chodashim rishon hu lachem lechodshei hashana. The very first mitzvah given to Am Yisrael as a nation, even before the Torah itself was given on Har Sinai, is this mitzvah, HaChodesh hazeh lachem rosh chodashim. And this is a mitzvah that really actually has two components to it. It's the mitzvah of Kiddush HaChodesh, mitzvah of setting a calendar, and the way in which the calendar is really supposed to be set, which we are unable to do nowadays, so we have a temporary solution until Mashiach comes, and or until we have a Sanhedrin again, I should say more precisely. And then we'll hopefully be able to go back to doing it the other way. But in theory, the Sanhedrin is supposed to every single month actively decide and declare which day is Rosh Chodesh, based on witnesses who saw the moon, even though the rabbis knew very well exactly when and where the new moon was supposed to appear. They knew how to do the mathematical calculations, the astronomical calculations, to know exactly when and where the new moon was to appear. So much so did they know this, that Rabban Gamliel, according to the Mishnah in Masechet Rosh Hashanah, was able to interrogate the witnesses and tell whether they were telling the truth or not, or whether they were mistaken or not, by he had a board with a series of pictures, different shapes of the moon, and he would ask them, show me exactly what you saw, where in the sky did you see it, when did you see it, and since he knew exactly when and where the moon was supposed to appear and what it was meant to look like from the astronomical calculations, he was able to tell. But nevertheless, in spite of that, there's a mitzvah to use those witnesses and to hear their testimony and to declare the new moon on that basis. So that's the first aspect of it. And based on that is the entire Jewish calendar and all of the mo'adim, all of the holidays, etc., are all based on that, those decisions. But there's another aspect to this mitzvah as well. HaChodesh hazeh lachem, this month, which is the month that we call Nisan, in a moment you'll see why I'm just calling it that way, the month that we call Nisan, is to be the first of the months. Meaning, when we count the months of the year, we begin from Nisan, which leads, for example, to a very bizarre situation that Rosh Hashanah is in the seventh month. Right? That the year, when we switch from 1 year. Last year was Tavshin Ayin Dalet, now it's Tavshin Ayin Hey. That change happens not on the first day of the first month, as one might have assumed, but on the first day of the seventh month. Because Nisan is supposed to be the first month. And from that, the Torah then goes on to the laws of the Korban Pesach, which we will return to Bezrat Hashem in a few minutes. The Ramban, in commenting on this mitzvah, particularly the second aspect of it, the idea that the month that we call Nisan is to be counted as the first month, the Ramban tells us the following idea. Why is that important? If the year begins in Tishrei, so why not count Tishrei as the first month? It's much more logical. What's the significance? Count from here. Ramban writes, Zo mitzvah rishona shetziva kadosh baruch hu et Yisrael al yidei Moshe. Oh no, I'm sorry. Not that passage. here. Sheyimnu oto Yisrael chodesh harishon, umimenu yimnu kol hachodeshim. Sheni v'shlishi, ad tashlum shana b'shneim asar chodesh. Meaning this mitzvah is fulfilled not only in the month of Nisan, if we say this is the first month, but for example, we're currently at the very end of the month of Tevet. The month of Tevet is called the 10th month. And by referring to Tevet as the 10th month, you are indirectly referencing the fact that Nisan is the first, and therefore all year round, whenever we number the months, we are referencing the fact that they're being counted from Nisan. And what's the value of that? Kedei she'ez zikaron b'neis hagadol. Ki b'chol eit she'nazkir ha'chodoshim, yeh ha'neis nizkar. By doing so, we're going to always remember, and the Ramban doesn't actually say this, but perhaps especially because it seems somewhat illogical, that the year begins in Tishrei, and yet we count Tishrei as the seventh month. Whenever we use those numbers, it's going to serve as a, what you might call an educational device, to constantly remind us and constantly keep in our awareness the idea that Nisan is the first, because Nisan is the month in which this great miracle took place, nothing less than the Geulah, the redemption of the entire Am Yisrael. Be'alkein ein l'chodoshim shem b'Torah. And therefore there are no names for the months in the Torah. There is no Tevet or Cheshvan or Tishrei or Nisan in the Torah. El yomar b'chodesh ha'shlishi. V'omar v'yihi b'shana ha'sheni, b'chodesh ha'sheni, u'b'chodesh ha'revi'i. And he quotes a number of psukim where the Torah always refers to the months not by names but by numbers. In a few minutes the Ramban is going to explain how and why that practice changed, and why we now use names instead of numbers, and where the names came from. We'll get to that in a few minutes. But first he says, Ukimo shetiyah zechira b'yom ha-shabbat b'manotenu echad b'shabbat b'sheni b'shabbat kasher afaresh kach ha-zechira b'yitziat Mitzrayim. He says this is very similar to a different mitzvah. And he refers to a comment that he writes here that I'm going to explain, a comment that he makes slightly later on in Parshat Yitro, where there the Torah tells us, Zachor et Yom HaShabbat L'Kadsho. There's a mitzvah to remember Shabbat. And the Ramban holds, and he writes so in his commentary on that pasuk, that one fulfills the mitzvah of remembering Shabbat also, among other things, by the way in which we refer to the days of the week. Because in a similar fashion to what the Torah did with the months, and this we do, in Hebrew, Ad Hayom Hazeh, the days of the week also do not have names. We do not refer today as Tuesday, Ella, we refer to today as Yom Shlishi, because it's the third day counting towards Shabbat. And therefore, in the same way, whenever one refers to a day of the week, the only day that has a name is Shabbat. And all the other days have numbers. If I refer to today as Yom Shlishi, or yesterday as Yom Sheni, or tomorrow as Yom Revi'i, by doing so, I'm constantly reminding myself that these numbers are all counting towards Shabbat. And in doing so, I fulfill all week long the mitzvah of Zachor et Yom Shabbat L'Kadsho. And therefore, the idea of the months having numbers and not names, with Nisan being the first, and the idea of Shabbat the days of the week having numbers and not names, are both very similar concepts. They're both meant to fulfill the same purpose, the purpose of remembering the significance of the one that all the others are numbered according to. The Ramban then goes on to explain, if so, why did we stop doing that when it comes to the months? And he explains, Ukvar iskiu rabotenu zehainya, and he quotes the Gemara that explains this. Varmu shmot chodeshim alu imanu mi bavel. The names that we use, those are, I don't know if you ever thought of this, but the names of the months, Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, Tammuz, these are not Hebrew names. They're not Jewish names, and they're not even Hebrew, they're Persian. And they came from the names of the month that were used in Bavel, where we were sent in the exile after the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash. And that's why in the Tanakh, the Ramban explains, in the Tanakh, these names appear only in a few Sfarim. They appear in the book of Esther. Esther, you might recall, it talks about the poor, the lottery that Haman drew to decide what day, and it says that the poor came out, Bechodesh Shnei Masar Hu Chodesh Adar. It uses, and also other months that are referenced in Megillat Esther, it uses the same format. It gives the number and the name. So first of all, in Megillat Esther, which is written shortly after arriving in Bavel, or not so shortly, but within the first two generations, they're using the names as if it's needed to be explained. Maybe the people at that time still weren't fully familiar with what's Adar. Right? So they have to say that Adar is the 12th month. And later on in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah also, the months are used. So that shows us that this is something they picked up from with them in Bavel, and they brought them back to Eretz Yisrael with them. And it might seem strange that we held on to that, or it might seem inappropriate that we held on to that. Why are we using these non-Jewish names? And they're not just non-Jewish, by the way. At least some of them are based on idolatry.
I find it interesting because here in Israel, when you ask a date, when you want, like I would call and make an appointment for the 1st of January, and they would say, Rishon, Rishon.
Uh-huh.
And they don't call it by the...
That's interesting.
The day is January
1st. It's interesting. I don't know if there's any significance to it. Maybe it's just the way people do it. But if there is a significance, perhaps... there's some kind of subliminal, psychological aversion that Jews have to using names, because the names of the months in the Gregorian calendar also, at least some of them, are based on idolatry, right? I think the month of
January
is
James.
And that's
James, God who looked both ways.
Aha. There's also March is the Mars also, right? At least some of them are based on, some I think are based on also people, like August is Augustus Caesar, but at least some of them are based on idolatry. But the same thing is true with the Hebrew months. For example, Tammuz, right? There's a pasuk that discusses women who are mevakotet at Tammuz, some sort of pagan worship around a god called Tammuz. And I think a few of the other months also. So whereas, perhaps, there are those who might argue that we shouldn't even be using the Gregorian calendar, and if we are, perhaps it would be better to use it with numbers instead of names, and maybe that's where the Israeli custom developed, perhaps psychologically, subliminally, I don't know. Fascinating to contemplate. But we didn't do that with our own calendar. We continued, the Tanakh itself, and the rabbis, if you look through the Talmud uses the names of the months, not the numbers. And in the Ramban's time, and Ada Yom Hazeh, we use the names that came from the foreign culture among whom we lived in Chutz La'aretz, and that, according to the Ramban, based on the Gemara, is in fact correct. Why? So he quotes the Gemara, that's a Yerushalmi in Masechet Rosh Hashanah, Shemot HaChodeshim Alu Imanu MiBavel. They came up from Bavel with us. Ki Mitchila Lo Ayu Lehem Shemot Etzleinu. But why did we do that? Ki Vasibaba said the reason is Ki Mitchila Hayam Inyanam Zecher Litziat Mitzrayim. As I explained, originally we counted the months according to the numbers. In that way, constantly reminding ourselves whenever we write a check in modern terms or whatever it is, whenever we mention the date, always keeping in our minds the memory of Yitziat Mitzrayim. Aval Kasher Alinu Mi Bavel. When we came up from Bavel, v'nitkayem ma she'amar ha-katuv, v'lo yomar od chai Hashem asher he'elah b'nei Yisrael mi'eretz Mitzrayim, ki im chai Hashem asher he'elah v'asher hevi b'nei Yisrael mi'eretz tzafon, chazarnu l'kro ha-chodoshim b'shem she'nikra'im b'eretz Bavel, v'azkir ki sham amadnu, misham he'elanu Hashem yibarach. Very fascinating. The Ramban quotes a pasuk in the book of Yirmiyahu. Actually appears twice in Yirmiyahu. He quotes it from Perek Tet Zayin. It also appears in Perek Chaf Gimel. where Yirmiyahu prophesies before the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, that in the context of prophesizing that there's going to be a destruction, a terrible nevuot, to Churban that Yirmiyahu gave, he also gives nevuot nechama. He gives them the consolation even before the destruction is going to come, and he tells them that although something terrible is going to happen, and Yerushalayim is going to be destroyed, and the Mikdash is going to be destroyed, and many people are going to be killed, and the rest are going to be taken off into exile, but you will also come back, and there will be a redemption. And the redemption will be so great that no longer will people speak about it. No longer will people speak about God who took us out of Egypt, but they'll speak about the God who brought us back from the lands of the north, from Babel, from Persia, from the places to which you're going to be exiled. In other words, that redemption is going to be so great that in a certain sense it will eclipse the Yitziat Mitzrayim, and there's going to be something greater to remember. That's what Yirmiyahu prophesizes. Yirmiyahu is talking about the return from Babel after the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, but the Gemara in Masechet Brachot, I believe it's on Daf Yud Aleph Amud Bet, if I'm not mistaken, near the end of the first parak of Brachot, the Gemara interprets that pasuk also as a reference to the future ultimate redemption, Animot Mashiach, that when we are redeemed in the final redemption also, we're not going to speak about Yitziat Mitzrayim anymore, we're going to speak now about that redemption, because the later redemptions are going to eclipse the memory of the previous one. And therefore, the Ramban says, we correctly stopped referring to the months by the names Yom Chodesh HaShlishi, Chodesh HaAsiri, etc. Names which point back to Nisan and remind us of Yitziat Mitzrayim, but rather we continue to use the pagan names we used in Babylonia, because that's going to remind us, where do we get these funny names from? Elul, Tammuz, Shvat, these aren't even Hebrew, where do we come up with these names? By doing so, we're going to constantly remember that once upon a time we were in Babel, and God brought us out of Babel. So by using the Babylonian names, we're actually fulfilling the same mitzvah, says the Ramban, as was originally intended by HaChodesh HaZelechem. Ad kan divrei HaRamban. So I thought that was a very interesting idea. But I have two questions. Because the Ramban says that this idea of counting both the days of the week and the months of the year by numbers are each meant to serve a very similar purpose. Counting the days of the week by numbers is meant to constantly remind us of Shabbat, and counting the months of the year by numbers was originally meant to constantly remind us of Nisan, and later it was switched to the names. So there's a very clear parallel, but it disturbed me that there's also a distinction. Let's look at the numbers. The days of the week are numbered around Shabbat, and the months of the year are numbered around Nisan, but it works in the opposite way. In the days of the week, we fulfill Zachor Yom Shabbat L'Kodesho by making Shabbat the climax of the week. Every day is counting up. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, Shabbat. And then we start from 1 again. If that's what we want to do, then why is Nisan the first month of the year? Iyar should be the first month. Nisan should be the 12th. And we should be counting up all year. This is the 3rd month, the 4th month, the 5th month, until we get to the climax of Nisan. Or, alternatively, if that's not the way it's supposed to work, if putting it as number one is the indication that it's significant, then Shabbat should be Yom Rishon. And we should start with Yom Sheni. Or don't call it Yom Rishon. Call it Shabbat and then go Sheni through Shvi'i. Why is it that if the Ramban says that these two ideas are really the same concept, why is there a distinction between them? Why is Shabbat the last day of the week, whereas Nisan is the first year, the first month of the year? And furthermore, why is it, if these two things are so similar, why is it that the idea of remembering Yitziat Mitzrayim ultimately gets eclipsed or replaced by remembering what you might want to call Yitziat Bavel, and we switch the numbers for the names, but that never happens to, nothing ever changes the remembering of Shabbat and the creation of the world? If there are two similar concepts and we're supposed to remember them both, why is one eternal and the other not fully eternal? And I think that what I looked around a little bit. I didn't see anyone who answers this question. But what occurs to me as a possible answer to this question, or to both of these questions really, is that what seems to come out of this is something somewhat paradoxical. It seems that both of these two questions that I just asked point to the same reality, which is that Yetziat Mitzrayim is the foundation upon which everything is based, and therefore we count, that's the bottom, so to speak, when we build 1, 2, 3, beginning with that. Yetziat Mitzrayim is also something that can be ultimately replaced by other redemptions. There's a redemption from Bavel that's going to eclipse the redemption from Mitzrayim, and according to the Gemara, there's an ultimate redemption that will eclipse both of the previous ones. So Yetziat Mitzrayim is the foundation upon which everything is based, whereas Briyat HaOlam seems to be the climax towards which everything points. The days of the week count up to Shabbat. Shabbat is the final essence, the final perfection. And we know that, so on one hand that's somewhat paradoxical. I would have assumed the opposite. I would have assumed that the creation of the world is the foundation, and perhaps Yetziat Mitzrayim, where God revealed himself in the world, would be the climax. But these ideas seem to be pointing in the opposite direction. And I think that when we begin to think about it, we'll see that in fact that counterintuitive reality, that Yetziat Mitzrayim is the foundation and the creation of the world, so to speak, is the climax, this seems to be borne out by a number of different things. First of all, Shabbat is referred to in that context. The rabbis refer to Shabbat as Me'ein Olam Haba. Right? The Shabbat that we observe every week is a taste of the world to come. We refer to the end of days as Yom Shekulo Shabbat Umenucha. Right? So Shabbat actually is a prelude to and the end of days, or the goal of all of existence, and the end point of all of human history is one big Shabbat. Or, as the poet put it, and as we recite every day in our prayers, Adon Olam Asher Malach Beterim Kol Yitzir Nivra, right? God who ruled before anything was created. The first existence before anything was God. Ve'acharei kichlot hakol levado yimloch nora. After everything is over, he will again rule in solitude alone. In other words, the end of time, the climax of all of history, brings us back to the beginning of time. But Yetziat Mitzrayim is not that way. Yetziat Mitzrayim is the foundation upon which everything is based. I think I mentioned last week that when Hashem first revealed himself on Har Sinai, Anochi Hashem Elokecha Asher, not what you might have expected, Asher Barati Shamayim Va'aretz, not I am God who created the world, but Asher Hotzeiticha Me'aretz Mitzrayim Mibeit Avadim. I didn't mention it last week. I realized afterwards that I probably should have, but after realizing that it connected with this, I figured I'll do it now. But that insight comes from the book of the Kuzari. Is everyone here familiar with the book of the Kuzari? Right? Rabbi Yehuda Levi, 12th century Spain, writes a book of popular philosophy, that's probably the best way to put it. And he bases it around a fictional story that's itself based on a historical event, but a fictionalized story about this king who is seeking out the truth, and he interviews first a Aristotelian philosopher, and then a Muslim, and a Christian, and finally a Jewish rabbi, and decides that Judaism is the truth, and ultimately converts, and the book is the hypothetical conversation. So when he first meets the rabbi, the Melech HaKazarim, or the Kuzari as he calls him, he asks him, tell me what you believe. And, give me the sound bite. What's your religion all about? So the Chaver, he calls him, the rabbi says, Ani ma'amin b'elokei Abraham Yitzchak v'Yaakov, I believe in the God of the Avot, Asher otzi et b'nei Yisrael b'ototu moftini Mitzrayim, who took b'nei Yisrael out of Egypt with wonders and miracles, v'chilkelam b'midbar, took care of them in the desert, v'anchilam in Eretz Canaan, brought them into the land of Canaan, Asher ha'eviram etayam v'etayardein, all the miracles connected with Yetziat Mitzrayim and the process of going through the desert in Eretz Yisrael, that's what I believe in, v'asher shalach aleim et Moshe v'torato, ואחריו אלפי נביאים שכולם קראו את תורתו באדם שכר בכל שומרה בעונש לכל עובר עליה. And I believe that he called Moshe to be the chief prophet and gave him the Torah, and all the other prophets who repeated more or less what Moshe said, that's what I believe in. And the king responds to him, that's not what I expected you to say. And it's not what I think you should have said. V'chi lo haya lecha lomar ata ha-Yehudi. Ki ma'amin ata bevorei ha-olam, u'misadro u'manhigo, hu asher bracha. Don't you think you should have started by saying, I believe in God? You're jumping right to taking you out of Egypt. Why don't you first say, who's this God you believe in? The first thing you should have said to me is, I believe in the creator of the entire universe. Later on, if you want, you can tell me one of the points is that he did this. But I asked you what you believe in, and in your 1 minute soundbite, you told me about Yetziat Mitzrayim. You should have told me about the creation of the world. And the rabbi responds, no, that's not the way it works. Because he says, anybody could have talked about a creator. The philosophers also talk about creators. I believe in a creator, but that's not the essence of my belief. The essence of my belief is in the God who took us out of Egypt. And that is what is ultimately mechayev. That is what is ultimately the thing that requires me to follow the laws in the Torah. V'lachen, lo amar lo Moshe leParo. When Moshe appeared to Paro before Yetziat Mitzrayim, also he didn't identify himself as Elokei Hashemayim Be'aretz Shlachani Elecha. He didn't say the God of the universe sent me to you, but rather, or below Bori Uboracha Shlachani Elecha. Not my Creator and yours sent me to you, but rather, Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov, Elokei Ha'ivrim Shlachani Elecha. Our God, the God who guides the Jewish people. V'chein patach Eloha b'dabro el kol adat b'nei Yisrael. Anokhi Hashem Elokecha, Asher Otzeiticha me'eretz Mitzrayim, v'lo amar ani borei ha'olam, u'bora'achem. God therefore also identified himself at Har Sinai that way, as the God who took you out of Egypt, and not the God who created the world. And that's why I also spoke this way to you. And then he says, if that's true, the king responds to the rabbi, then the laws in your Torah obligate only you and not the rest of us. And the chaver, the rabbi, responds, Om Nam Kain. Indeed, that is correct. Kol mishenuva aleinu. He talks about how others can join us and become part of our nation, and then the Torah obligates them as well. But the Torah, in its full form, does not obligate the rest of the world. Ki ilu haya chiyuv haTorah mitzad ma she'eloka barad kulanu. If the Torah would be based on the fact that God created all of us, then hayu shavim b'kol ben adam. Then all people would have to keep the Torah, the full Torah, not just the laws of Bnei Noach. Aval, because they're all created by God. Ulam chiyuv haTorah aleinu hu mitzad ma she'otzianu ha'eloka mimitzrayim, mitzad heyot lo hitchavrut imanu. Therefore, the Torah obligates only those who were taken out of Mitzrayim or those who join with that people. So the foundation of all of our belief and of all of our avodat Hashem is not the creation of the world, but Yetziat Mitzrayim. The creation of the world perhaps is that that all of history is marching towards, but our history, the foundation, and that's why I think perhaps we count from Yetziat Mitzrayim and not towards it. The idea that Yetziat Mitzrayim is the mechayev, that Yetziat Mitzrayim is that seminal event or that foundational principle upon which all of our obligations to serve God is based, we find also in Kriyat Shema. There's a mitzvah of Kriyat Shema, which is a mitzvah d'oraita. And as we know, of course, Kriyat Shema has three parshiot, three sections from the Torah that we're meant to recite every single morning and every single evening. The first two of those, it's very clear where the source comes from, because the parsha itself says in the text that you have to recite these words every morning and every night. B'shoch b'cha, Uvikumecha. It says that in the first parsha. V'dibarta bam v'shivtecha b'vaitecha v'lechtecha b'derech uvishokpecha uvikumecha. And a very similar phrase in the second parsha. L'daber bam v'shivtecha b'vaitecha v'lechtecha b'derech uvishokpecha uvikumecha. B'shokpecha when you lie down, of course, is at night. Uvikumecha, and in the morning. So it's very, very clear where the obligation to recite those two parshiot comes from. But what about the third? The third parsha is the parsha of Tzitzit. First of all, Tzitzit, it's a little bit strange why that is something. Tzitzit is a mitzvah. There are 613 mitzvot in the Torah. It's not clear at first glance what makes the mitzvah of Tzitzit so fundamental that it has to be recited twice a day. And by the way, the mitzvah of Tzitzit only applies in the day. The mitzvah doesn't even obligate us at night. And yet, there's even a thought in the Gemara that perhaps we shouldn't say it at night, because it's not even relevant. And that mitzvah gets stuck in there as the third passage in Kriyat Shema. If you read the Gemara, again, that same Gemara Masechet Brachot that I mentioned earlier, it's clear that the obligation to read the Parsha of Tzitzit is a different obligation. It's not intrinsically connected with Kriyat Shema. But rather, it's something else. There's a mitzvah in the Torah that we have to remember Yitziat Mitzrayim every single day and every single night. The Mishnah there at the end of Masechet Brachot is a Mishnah that's familiar to every single person here, probably by heart, because we recite a version of that mitzvah every year at the Pesach Seder. Amar Rabbi Elazar ben Azaria, Hare ani keven shivim shana, velo zachiti sheteyamer Yitziat Mitzrayim balilot. Here I am almost 70 years old, or perhaps as if I was 70 years old, depending on how you understand that, and I never understood one thing. How is it that we're supposed to remember Yitziat Mitzrayim at night, or mention it every night, and not only in the day? Ad Shedrasha Ben Zoma, until finally Ben Zoma came along and explained it to me. Because what does the pasuk say? Leman tizkor et yom tzeitcha me'eretz Mitzrayim kol yimei chayecha. The Torah says we have to remember Yitziat Mitzrayim all the days of our life. So I always thought it should be only in the daytime. Until Ben Zoma came along and said, Yimei chayecha hayamim, kol yimei chayecha halelot. There's also another opinion in the Mishnah there. But the point is that pasuk teaches us that there's an obligation to remember Yitziat Mitzrayim every single day, and at least according to Rabbi Elazar ben Azaria, also every single night. And that mitzvah we fulfill by reciting the Parsha of Tzitzit, which mentions at the end, Anochi Hashem Elokecha Asher Hotzeiticha Me'eretz Mitzrayim. So according to that Mishnah, the entire reason we recite Parshat Tzitzit is because of just that last pasuk, Anochi Hashem Elokecha Asher Hotzeiticha Me'eretz Mitzrayim. Now when I first learned that, it bothered me. Because if that's the reason, I understand, okay, fine, there's a mitzvah to remember Yitziat Mitzrayim every single day. Got it. And every single night, fine. But first of all, where does one see that that mitzvah has to be done together with Kriyat Shema? Sounds like two separate things. There are these two passages you're supposed to say. And secondly, you're also supposed to remember Yitziat Mitzrayim. Why does it have to be in part of Kriyat Shema? Why couldn't it be earlier or later at some other time? And even more fundamentally, why the Parsha of Tzitzit? You didn't answer the question. You told me that it mentions Yitziat Mitzrayim. That's true. But there's no shortage of passages in the Torah that mention Yitziat Mitzrayim. It's all over the Torah. And frankly, there seem to be other passages that could have been much more appropriate. How about reading something from Parsha Vayera Bo B'Shalach? Or, if you want other places, how about reading the first beginning of Seretz HaDibrot, Anochi Hashem Lokecha Asher Hotzeiticha Me'eretz Mitzrayim Mibeit Avadim? It's very similar words to the end of Parsha Tzitzit, but it's a lot more dramatic. Or how about what we do at the Pesach Seder? The Pesach Seder, if you want a slightly longer text that talks about Yitziat, shorter than this text, but more discussion of Yitziat Mitzrayim, how about reading the Psukim of Arami Oved Avi, which we read at the Pesach Seder, which we study, literally, Doresh. We analyze and study the Pesach Seder. Why? The Parsha Tzitzit, of all things. And according to many, this decision was made not by the Torah itself, but by the rabbis. It's not 100% clear from the Gemara, but that seems to be what at least many of the Rishonim, I believe the majority understand, that the Torah commanded us to recite the two parshiot of Kriyat Shema. The Torah also commanded us to remember Yitziat Mitzrayim every day and every night, but the Torah did not obligate us with a particular text, nor did the Torah specifically tell us when to do it. The two mitzvot. You have to recite Kriyat Shema every morning and every night. You also have to remember Yitziat Mitzrayim every morning and every night. The rabbis, according to most, are those who came along and said, okay, You're going to do the mitzvah of the Torah, but we rabbinically are going to add two details. First of all, we're going to pick the text. Many, many texts could have been used to remember Yetziyat Mitzrayim. Maybe one doesn't even need a text. Maybe they could have formed their own text. Maybe one could just say those words, God took us out of Egypt or something like that. But we, the rabbis, are going to command you, midrabanan, that we want you to use specifically the parsha of Tzitzit. And not only that, we're going to tell you when we want you to do it. We want you to do it immediately following the two parshiot of Kriyat Shema. And why? Because, first of all, what is Kriyat Shema? The two parshiot of Kriyat Shema. The first parsha establishes the fundamentals of belief. Shema Yisrael. Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, Ve'ahavta et Hashem Elokecha. V'chol levavcha, v'chol nafshecha, v'chol miyodecha. The second, so that's the fundamental, belief and love of God. Willingness to sacrifice for God, perhaps. But no details. The second paragraph of Shema, second parsha, discusses the obligation of mitzvot. V'haya im shamoa tishmu el mitzvotah. Le'avdo, it says. The first parsha says, v'yahavta et Hashem elokecha. The second one says, le'avdo, to serve Him, which means to perform the mitzvot, v'chol levavchem u'v'chol nafshechem. And it speaks specifically of mitzvot, and it speaks of the reward for performing mitzvot and the punishment, God forbid, for failing to perform the mitzvot. What is the third parasha about? The third parasha is about the mitzvah tzitzit. Now it's true that the mitzvah tzitzit is a particular mitzvah, one of the 613, if you will, but it's one of a small number of mitzvot where the Torah itself tells us exactly what the mitzvah is about. Most of the mitzvot in the Torah, it doesn't give us the reason. Later commentaries speculate about what the reason is. Some it's more clear, some it's less clear. But there are a few mitzvot where the Torah tells us exactly. And here's one of them. The tzitzit is supposed to have a ptil techelet. Right? It's supposed to have a blue string on it. And it says, uri item oto. You're supposed to see that blue string without getting into now what the blue is and how that accomplishes this. But it says, uri item oto. Uzechartem et kol mitzvot Hashem ve'asitem otam. The purpose of the tzitzit is to serve as a reminder that we have to fulfill all of the mitzvot. And then it goes on and says, V'lo taturu acharei levavchem acharei neichem asher atem zonim achareihem v'man tizkeru v'asitem et kol mitzvotai v'asitem otam ani Hashem Elokeichem asher hotzeiti etchem me'eretz Mitzrayim liyot lachem le'elokim ani Hashem Elokeichem. So the mitzvah of tzitzit is a mitzvah that's meant to serve as a reminder that we are obligated to do all of the mitzvot. And in that context, God identifies Himself as the God who took you out of Egypt. Echoing the fact that, basically what the Kuzari later wrote, that the obligation to perform mitzvot is based on the idea that God took us out of Egypt. That is what makes us obligated in the mitzvot. And that's why the rabbis also, in addition to choosing that parsha, appended it to the two parshiot of Kriyat Shema. Because now Kriyat Shema has a three-part progression. First, we declare our belief in God and our commitment to God in a general sense. Secondly, we declare our commitment to do the mitzvot. And thirdly, we anchor that commitment in the source of that commitment, which is Yetziyat Mitzrayim. So the rabbis took what could have been two independent mitzvot and brought them together in this way, sort of as an added value package or something like that. It's also, this idea can also be seen not only in the text of the Torah, but also psychologically and philosophically. Throughout history, people have developed all kinds of different belief systems and all sorts of philosophies. And over the last, in ancient times, everyone believed in some sort of god or gods. But over the last several hundred years, another form of belief has developed called atheism, of one form or another. And there are today, of course, people who claim that perhaps there's no god at all. Now, one of the such a belief is, on the one hand, a belief that some people, philosophers and thinkers and others, declare and commit themselves to. But it's a belief that's both philosophically and psychologically somewhat difficult. It's really very, very difficult to conceive. I'm having a conversation, as I've mentioned many times. I'm taking a tour guide course at the moment. And One of the more minor subject matters in the course is botany. Something that I'm actually not all that interested in, but at least wasn't. I've gotten more interested in it because of the course. But study plants. So that when you go around, you can tell people what the plants are and show them, etc. And so for the first time since I was in high school, I had to learn the parts of a flower and, you know some basic things about plants. And, it just amazes me every time I look at this, you know, something as simple as a flower, the ingenuity of, I mean, there's just these plants that grow in the desert, and they have all these complex mechanisms to preserve water and to make sure that they are able to survive the harsh conditions, and to make sure that they bloom at exactly the right time, and that the flowers can be fertilized and the seeds can be spread. And they become so sophisticated, and they also have to protect themselves against predators. Plants have, some of them are poisonous, and some of them have thorns, and some of them have, there's even these plants. There's a flower called dvoranit, right, which needs bees to come and pollinate it. It has a fake bee on it. That's why it's called dvoranit in Hebrew. Like, there's this little growth, that little black thing that grows in the middle of the flower that looks kind of like a bee. And what happens is, and they've seen this scientifically, and the bees are flying around, and the bee looks down and says, "Ooh, there's another bee there. It must be something good to eat." And he flies down, and the stupid bee, the flower's smart, the bee's stupid, because every time he goes again and again and again and doesn't figure it out, apparently. But that happened by itself. It just defies logic that something so... And this is a flower. I'm not talking about the human body, which is... It's just so difficult to conceive of such a concept. And therefore... Both in modern times and also in ancient times, there's a different form of belief, something that's not exactly atheism, that solves a psychological and a philosophical problem, but also may serve a different psychological and philosophical need. And there was a philosophy at one point, it was called deism. Although, even before that term, Aristotle also had a similar god, perhaps. The belief that, okay, fine, there's a god who created the world, yes, but that God has nothing to do with it. He created the world and he moved on, or he's aloft, lofty up there in the high heavens or something, and has nothing to do with what goes on here on earth. And that belief has both a philosophical and a psychological advantage to it. The philosophical advantage is that on the one hand, it acknowledges that there is a creator, and it explains how this universe came into existence, but it also avoids one of the problems with belief is how do you explain the existence of evil and tzaddik viralo, as we call it, and how all such, if there's a God, right, that's, if something like a flower is a reason to believe, then tragedies that occur perhaps is a reason not to believe. So the deist says, I solved it. There's a God. He created the world, but if you want to know why, he's allowing terrible things to occur because he's not involved in the world. It also serves a psychological need. It allows us to believe in something beyond us, that there's something greater than us, and perhaps there's something beyond our lives and beyond the grave and all the psychological things that people have. But it also has the advantage of not obligating us to do anything if one has such a belief. Perhaps that's another angle in what the Torah was trying to do by showing us that our obligation and the foundation of our belief is not Briyat HaOlam, but Yitziat Mitzrayim. Because Briyat HaOlam says that there's a creator. Fine, there's a creator, you can still be a deist. Yitziat Mitzrayim says that God not only created the world, but that God is very much involved in the world, that God runs the world, that He controls what happens in the world, that He chose Am Yisrael specifically, that Am Yisrael has a destiny, and it's not by accident that when Am Yisrael came out of Mitzrayim, their destination was not directly to go to Eretz Canaan, the promised land, but there was a stop in between, Har Sinai. And as Hashem told Moshe when he stood at the burning bush, that's the real destination. He was told at that very first moment, the Snebo Er Ba'esh, the burning bush, took place where? Anyone remember? Where was that bush?
The desert.
The desert. You're correct. Can we be more specific? Which desert and where in that desert? It says explicitly. It was on Har Sinai. It says that Moshe was taking the sheep through the desert and he came to Har HaElokim Choreva, the mountain of Chorev, which is another name for Sinai, it's called Har HaElokim. That's where he saw the bush. And what it says to him there is, V'hotziach ha'ta'am in Mitzrayim, ta'avduna ta'elokim al ha'har hazeh. Moshe was told from the very beginning that the ultimate destination from coming out of Mitzrayim is to go into Eretz Kanaan, but first they have to come to that mountain. And there they're going to serve God, and there, of course, they receive the Torah. So Yetziat Mitzrayim says to us not only that there's a God, doesn't only solve our theological questions. Yetziat Mitzrayim tells us that God is involved in this world, He rewards the righteous and punishes the wicked, and He commands us. Anochi Hashem Elokecha asher hotzeiticha me'eretz Mitzrayim. And therefore, perhaps, we count up from Yetziat Mitzrayim as the foundation, and Yetziat Mitzrayim later becomes replaced by other redemptions that take that process even further. The Gemara says, by the way, it's not going to be completely eclipsed. It's not that we don't remember Yetziat Mitzrayim anymore, it's just that there are other things that we remember more directly or more immediately, because we don't need any longer to talk about God who took us out of Mitzrayim. We can talk about God who brought us up from Babel. And if I would dare say that we're already in the midst of the final third redemption, so perhaps living here in Medinat Yisrael, we don't need to go back to what happened only thousands of years ago. We can see it in front of our own eyes here. It's the same thing. And therefore, by calling the months by their Persian names or whatever other formulas we have, we're really fulfilling that same concept of remembering Yetziat Mitzrayim. Okay. I have 11 minutes now for my second board. Probably won't get to the third. And we'll see if these connect. Okay. So that's about HaChodesh HaZeh Lachem. The Torah then continues with the mitzvah of the Korban Pesach. Now, the mitzvah of the Korban Pesach, the laws of the Korban Pesach are given to us here in two forms, because there are two different korbanot that are discussed here in Parshat Bo. There's what's called Pesach Mitzrayim and Pesach Dorot. There's the Korban Pesach that they brought that first year in Mitzrayim, that was directly connected with and brought about the redemption. And then there's the mitzvah to, so to speak, reenact it every single year on the 14th of Nisan to bring the Korban Pesach on the afternoon of the 14th of Nisan and to eat the Korban at night on the 15th at the Leila Seder. So these are two very closely related mitzvot. They had brought the Korban in Egypt and they have to bring the Korban again every year, but there are differences. Not all the laws are the same, because Pesach Mitzrayim had one purpose, and Pesach Dorot is meant to remember Pesach Mitzrayim. One of the mitzvot that applied only in Mitzrayim and is not reenacted in future years is that when the Korban is to be slaughtered, you have to put the blood on the doorposts. Al shtei mezuzot ve'al mashkof. The mezuzot are the sides of the door, and the mashkof is the top. So here I would put it on this side, and on this side, and up here. Right? That was only in Pesach Mitzrayim. That isn't done in future years when you bring the Korban Pesach. And what was the purpose of that? So it tells you exactly what the purpose is. I'm reading from Perek Yebet. I'll start from Pasuk Vav. Another thing is that the animal has to be prepared 4 days in advance. That was only Mitzrayim. Then you have to hold it on until the 14th. Ad Arba Sayom L'Chodesh Hazeh. When you get to the 14th of Nisan, in the afternoon, then everyone has to slaughter the Korban. And place it on the doorposts and on the, I think it's called the lintel, on the top of the door. And then, I'm skipping now, to Pasuk Yudbet. What's the purpose of this? Vavarti be'eretz Mitzrayim b'layla hazeh, v'keticho b'chor be'eretz Mitzrayim. I will, kill all the b'chorot. U'v'chol Elohim Mitzrayim eseh shvatim ani Hashem, v'aya adam lachem leot, al abatim asher atem sham, v'ra'iti et adam u'fasachti aleichem, lo yevachem negef l'mashchit pakoti be'eretz Mitzrayim. The dam, the blood, will serve as like a secret code. I'm going to go through Egypt, and when I see the houses that have the dam on the doors, I'll know that that house is yours, and when I go around destroying all of the, killing all the bechorot, so I'll skip those houses. It sort of reminds us of later on, when Am Yisrael entered Eretz Canaan. So if you recall, Yoshua sent two spies to Jericho to plan out the conquest. And those spies got into a little bit of trouble. They were staying at the house of Rachav HaZonah, and the king found out about them, and they were going to be arrested and assumedly killed. And Rachav, risking her own life, hid them and managed to, you know, get the police to go away. And then she told them how to escape the city and hide in the mountains, etc. And she said, listen, I saved your lives. I have a request. You're going to come in and conquer the city. I'd like you to spare my family. In return for what I did for you, I'd like to not be killed with everybody else. And they agreed, and they told her that this is what you should do. Tie a red string in the window. Don't tell anybody about it, because if we find that anyone knew, then the deal's off. But all the soldiers are going to know that the one house with the red string, you'll stay in your house, and nobody will promise you you'll be okay. So it sounds sort of like a similar idea, this code. Nobody, assumedly people saw the red string in her window, but they had no idea what it meant and what it represented, and therefore she was spared. But of course, so there's a parallel, but the parallel immediately breaks down when you ask, but wait a second. I understand that the Jewish soldiers who are going to destroy Jericho need some kind of a symbol to make sure that they, especially in the heat of battle, even if they would have given them the address, there's always the danger. So it makes sense that if you want to tell human soldiers to make sure that there's one house where the people are going to be protected, that you put some kind of signal on the door. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't need a signal like that. God knows exactly what He's doing.
Maybe He needed them to show that they were committing themselves.
I think you're correct. And not only do I think you're correct, I think that's exactly what the Pasuk says. What I just said, the question I asked is based on a misinterpretation of the Pasuk. Let's read the Pasuk again. Vavayti Beretz Mitzrayim Balayla Azeh. I will cross Mitzrayim on this night. V'keiti kol b'chor Beretz Mitzrayim me'adam ha'behima. V'haya hadam lachem le'ot. V'ra'iti et hadam u'fasachti alechem. It does say that I will see the blood, and therefore I will skip over you. But it does, if the idea is what the straw man that I set up in order to ask the question, that this is similar to the signal at Jericho, if the spies would use this terminology when speaking to Rachav, what would they have said to her? V'haya hadam, or the red string, lanu le'ot. Right? If God needed this as a symbol, He would have said, V'haya hadam li le'ot, that'll be my sign to know not to, V'ra'iti et hadam ufasakti lechem. That's not what He said. God doesn't need that. V'haya hadam lachem liot. It's for you. Rashi, on that pasuk, quotes that from that, there's even a halachic thing, that lachem liot v'lo la'acherim mekan shelo nadnu hadam ela mibifnim, that the blood was placed on the inside of the door, not on the outside. Again, if it's meant to allow whoever's passing through the streets to know which house to skip, the dam should be on the outside. It's on the inside, because it's not for God, it's for you. And I think the reason for that is exactly what you said. The Ramban, going back to the Ramban, tells us that according to the rabbis, the lamb that was slaughtered at the Korban Pesach was in fact a god that was worshipped in Mitzrayim. There's a hint to that in the text itself. And therefore, Bnei Yisrael, in order to be able to be redeemed from Egypt, they have to, with their own hands, take the god of Mitzrayim, which is the culture in which they've been immersed, and slaughter it. Yechezkel in Perek Chaf tells us that most people didn't really do that. They were told in Yechezkel Perek Chaf, it says, for lack of time I won't read it inside, but that God commanded us before leaving Mitzrayim that we have to ish et gilei einav hishlichu, that everyone has to take their pagan gods and throw them away, and that we didn't do it. And according to Chazal, at least one midrash, only 20% of Am Yisrael got out of Mitzrayim. It says v'chamushim, Parsha B'shalach, v'chamushim alu b'nei Yisrael me'eretz Mitzrayim. Chamushim literally means they came up from Egypt armed with weapons, but the rabbis read it as chamushim, chamishit, a fifth, right? And only one fifth, and the other four remained behind, assumedly because they couldn't bring themselves to do this. In order for God to redeem us from Egypt, we first have to psychologically redeem ourselves. You have to take that object, that animal which is revered by the Egyptians, with the most important thing, the most sacred thing in this entire culture, and with your own hands you have to slaughter it. and put the dam on the doorpost, on the inside of the door. You have to be able to show yourself that you're committing yourself not to the culture in which you grew up, not to that which perhaps you've believed until now, but that you're committing to follow Hashem. When I see that you've done that, ufasachti aleichem, and then I will be able to redeem you. So that's my understanding of the idea of the blood on the door for the Korban Pesach. So those were the two vertelach, the two ideas, and perhaps they do connect in some way. I thought maybe because they're both aspects of the same idea, that Yitziat Mitzrayim is the fundamental basis for our obligation in mitzvot. So look at them as two separate things, or look at them as one, as you wish. That's the basic idea.